Good evening, Truth Seeker. Malloy here on Nova M Radio Network. How you doing? Hope you had a great weekend. Did you watch the Academy Awards? Did you? We did. I think my favorite part this year was Jennifer Hudson when she got the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress and said, "Look what God can do." Yeah, that's what she said. Apparently, God can't stop disease, he can't handle war, and doesn't know what the hell to do about famine, but by golly, he can make sure Jennifer Hudson gets an Oscar! You gotta love a God like that! People dying by the millions in Darfur? People being eaten alive by AIDS in Africa? Well, I'm busy! Damn it, I gotta make sure Jennifer gets her Oscar! Still, it was not so bad as last year when the rap star thanked God for his Oscar for the song "It's Hard Out Here on a Pimp." To be a pimp. What? Hard out where? For a pimp. It's hard out here for a pimp. That's going to go down in history as my favorite all-time Oscar moment, right after the one where Cher came out, you know, in that dress. That was the favorite. But last year, "It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp." And he got his Oscar, and he knelt down and said, "Thank you, Jesus," or God, or some cloud being. And it's like, oh, Lord, now I get it. And then Jennifer Hudson last night, "Look what God can do." Yeah, Jennifer, look what God can do, huh? Huh. More like, "Look what Simon Cowell can do, Jennifer." You know, never mind. Gee, why get into it? Why get into it? We've got some God stuff for you coming up, though, that is astonishing. Christianity may be on the verge of collapsing into a pile of dead bones. Things in bizarro, backward Bush world keep getting zanier and zanier. Last week, the Bush crime family said that the British troop withdrawal was a sign of a progress and glory and the second coming. And Cheney was right, and it was glorious and wonderful. But a U.S. troop withdrawal would be admitting defeat, cutting and running, slobbering Democrats in the House and the Senate who are actually cowards, and on and on and on. Then the human flesh eater, Dick Cheney, said that the Martha Pelosi plan to protect our troops from slaughter would in fact endorse Al-Qaeda. Right? Ironically, the Bush crime family is assisting Al-Qaeda by covertly funneling money to Sunni groups with ties to Al-Qaeda in a proxy war against Hezbollah. You got that straight? You need a flowchart. Yes, this is Seymour Hersh's article that's in the current issue of, I believe, the New Yorker, and it's at Truth Out and all over the place. Go figure. I mean, figure out these crazed son of a bitches. Now, this is so bad. Why doesn't Jennifer Hudson come out and say, "Thank you, God, now would you focus on Bush?" So the Democrats who want to end the war are the bad guys. Because, according to Cheney, they're siding with the terrorists. But the Bushites, who actually fund the terrorists, are the good guys. Son of a bitch. Will somebody explain? No, don't even try to explain it to me. This is what madness looks like. This is what a nation looks like whose leaders are totally insane. We have some of the sound from Cy Hersh on CNN with the former German U-boat commander himself, Wolf Blitzer, and a bit of Jimmy Carter, and I think one on Foxy the Snowman, the worst press secretary in the history of the Republic. A little bit of everything for you tonight, huh? It's a typical Monday night here at the Malloy Program. Oh, my God. Now, as far as the, James Cameron, who is Academy Award-winning director, has had a film crew for the Discovery Channel in Jerusalem checking out a discovery. It was actually made about 20 years ago, 27 years ago. Two small caskets caught the interest of Cameron and the Discovery Channel. They were part of 10 that were found 27 years ago during construction of an apartment complex in South Jerusalem. Now, several of these little ossuaries, they call them, little bone containers, had inscriptions translated from Aramaic, I believe, as Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and Judah, son of Jesus. That's how they translate it. Now, I've heard people today, because the story, of course, has been repeated until I'm just over it already. But according to the spin that's being put on this story now, oh, well, there are all kinds of families back then named Jesus, Mary, and Judah, son of Jesus. Oh, hell, there must have been 100 of them. Doesn't mean a thing. Anyway, James Cameron displayed today artifacts that he said might have come from the tomb of Jesus, which possibly contained the remains of his wife and their son. Oh my God! Didn't we just go through this with the, what was it? The Da Vinci Code? Did we? Yeah, I think we did. Now, of course, people who are skeptical of this sort of stuff. You know, people are not skeptical of someone who dies and then comes back alive and floats up to heaven and wherever that is and hangs out with winged creatures and does that's not skepticism, that's belief. And someone who challenges that, you see, is, oh, you're going to burn in hell. Skeptics of this ossuary, this discovery, say, nah, it's just a publicity stunt. That's all it is. Just a publicity stunt. None of this is true. Move on. Nothing here. Move on! There was a news conference today. James Cameron had a news conference at the New York Public Library. And, you know, you take it for what it's worth. I don't know. Since I'm not involved in religious claptrapic nonsense, I do find it amusing. I do believe there was a man named Jesus Christ. Well, that was the honorific that was added, but Jesus of Nazareth and his wife, Mary Magdalene. I don't know how many kids they had, but I'm sure that there was a man named Jesus. There's enough historical record to say that there was somebody named Jesus who wandered around with 12 men in the Middle East, a Palestinian Jew who wandered around with 12 other Palestinian Jews, telling people, look, you can't beat people up and have them say, I love you! Stop killing! Of course I believe that. Was he the son of some spook, of some transcendent spook? I don't think so. I think he was just a man who, you know, tried to do right 2,000 years ago. Now, in Jerusalem, the Israeli archaeologists who also carried out excavations at the tomb on behalf of the Israel Antiquities Authority says he doesn't agree with James Cameron's documentary conclusions. The archaeologist named Amos Cloner said the 2,000-year-old cave contained coffins belonging to a Jewish family. Well, yeah, whose names were similar to those of Jesus and his relatives. Similar. Judah, son of Jesus. Yeah, that's similar. Cloner told the Reuters news agency, quote, I can say positively that I don't accept the identification as belonging to the family of Jesus in Jerusalem. I don't accept that the family of Miriam and Joseph, Mary and Joseph, the parents of Jesus, had a family tomb in Jerusalem. They were a very poor family. They resided in Nazareth. They came to Bethlehem in order to have the birth done there. Wait a minute, Professor. You're getting very close to the myth. So I don't accept it, he says. Not historically, not archaeologically. Now, after they were discovered back in 1980, the bones were reburied according to Orthodox Jewish tradition, leaving just the boxes with inscriptions and human residue to be examined through ongoing DNA testing. If they were just reburied 27 years ago, how hard is it to, you know, dig them up? Now, when they do DNA testing, I mean, how do you get an inside cheek swab off of God to see if this is really his son or not? I mean, how do you do that, huh? Hey, God! Can you come down here? Jennifer Hudson wants to talk to you. And while he's down here, you know, just grab him, wrestle him to the ground. Jacob did it, or no, that was an angel. And stick a cotton swab in his mouth, go swab, 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 and take it out, and there you go. You know, if they do get the swab and they need a decision, get that judge from the Anna Nicole trial to sit there and, you know, well, no, I'll tell you. Jesus Christ, I don't believe this, so to speak. I don't know. God, you have anything to say?
Reality Radio for a Rational World. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
This is Christ the King, who shepherds God and angels sing.
That happens to be one of my favorite Christmas carols. I really like that one. Oh, it's so pretty. The Al Sharpton Strom Thurmond story, doesn't that give you shivers? Al Sharpton says he wants a DNA test to determine whether he is related to former segregationist Strom Thurmond through his great-grandfather, a slave that was owned by an ancestor of the late senator. These are very small circles. If you go back far enough, that's why you know, people in this country who have been here longer than, say, you know, the turn of the century, are white people, Caucasian people, whose families have been here for all these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. I have a secret for you. You're not going to like it. Some of you white folks, you probably have a little bit of that old Negroid blood running through your veins. You know, just like so-called black people in this country. Have you noticed that black people in America are not black? They're like some kind of mocha. Mocha Americans. But it's, you know, when they talked about, used to talk about it, don't talk about it anymore. They used to talk about this as a melting pot. What do you think they were talking about? What do you think they were talking about? So usually when you scratch a Caucasian deep enough, if that Caucasian has had bloodlines in this country for three or four centuries, eventually you find where they intersect with some of those ladies that live down in the quarters, if you know what I'm talking about, right? So Al Sharpton and Strom Thurmond, oh my God, that's enough to make your blood run cold. But Thurmond is already on the DNA record of having, how do we say, spread his seed rather proficiently through the quarters. SMA Washington, if that rings a bell. Sharpton told the New York Daily News, who broke this story, I can't find out anything more shocking than I've already learned. You know, it's got to be hell. It's got to be just living hell. This would be like some white racist. Who's that guy from Louisiana? You know, the Klansman. What the hell is his name? Had the face job. Come on, you know who I mean. He was in Iran for the anti-Holocaust convention. Oh Jesus, David. It's hard out here on an old person. David Duke. Thank you, Kathy. You know, what if David Duke found out that way back in his bloodline, he had somebody who of color, you know, somebody from Ghana, you know, if you check back far enough, that would make David Duke probably reach for the poison bottle, you know, and end it all. Well, can you imagine Al Sharpton? If Al Sharpton finds out he's related to Strom Thurmond, and I love the way the Associated Press puts it, it says Sharpton and Thurmond didn't appear to have much in common. Yeah, I guess not. So anyway, a professional genealogist who worked for Ancestry.com found that Sharpton's great-grandfather, Coleman Sharpton, was a slave who was owned by Julia Thurmond, whose grandfather was Strom Thurmond's great-great-grandfather. You follow me there? No, I'm reading it and I can't follow it. So anyway, I just think this is all hysterically funny. Just hysterically funny. I don't care what Caucasian or person of the Negroid race that you look at in America, who have been here for a long time, and we reflect each other. I frankly think that the way to solve all this racial nonsense is forced mixed dating and marriage. Force it. You have to get a marriage license of some sort if you want to have children, not a marriage license, but a procreation license. And in order to procreate, only mixed people of different races can procreate. And with two generations, problem solved. Hey, we try to solve problems on the Molloy program, not make them. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us if you have the guts. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Molloy.
Let's go to a couple phone calls here real quick before we move on into other topics, starting with Danny in the Gulf Shores, Alabama. Hey, Danny, welcome to the program.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine.
Are we on the air, or is this
No, you're on the air, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I didn't really have anything particularly profound to add other than the fact that I'm a Southerner originally from Birmingham, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And I think the whole thing with Mr. Sharpton and the Strom Thurmond family is just totally hilarious. That on one level, at least, it's hilarious that that they're going to have to may have to acknowledge that they might even be related to Mr. Sharpton. And most of the, being originally from Birmingham, I got a belly full of the racism many years ago, and. Mm-hmm. Tried to work my way through it. I was listening to Fox on satellite radio. John Gibson is has a show, and he's trying to stir the pot earlier with his thinly veiled racism. Then I heard who's the guy? O'Reilly, to put words into Mr. Sharpton's mouth about why this was important to him, and. That's about it. I just thought it was pretty funny that they managed to acknowledge this.
I think it's funny too, Danny. I really do. Thanks a lot for checking in. I do appreciate it. The thing about John Gibson, the whitest white man I've ever seen on television, and O'Reilly, Bill O'Reilly, the second whitest white man I've ever seen on television, they're brothers. They are actual brothers. The reason they don't look alike is that their parents were brother and sister. And when you have a situation like that, you have recessive genes that just pop out all over the place. But Bill O'Reilly and John Gibson are blood brothers. They're full blood brothers. And that's because their mother and father are brother and sister. That sort of thing happens quite frequently. Peggy is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Peggy.
Hey.
Hey.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
I haven't talked to you in a long time.
No, you haven't.
Yeah. About the Sharpton-Thurmond connection. I heard it summarized on Keith Olbermann tonight, just shortly before he told Tor Conde a new one.
Yeah?
Yeah. What it amounts to is that Al Sharpton's great-grandfather was owned by Strom Thurmond's first cousin twice removed.
Yeah.
So that means it was his grandfather's first cousin.
Okay.
So it's a fairly close relationship to Strom himself.
Yeah. I don't think they look the least alike. Do you?
They don't.
I don't see any similarities. Now Charlie Rangel and Strom Thurmond, that's a different
story. Yeah, that's a different story.
That's a different story. But yeah. but Al Sharpton and Strom Thurmond, I see no family resemblance there.
No.
whatsoever.
My relatives, my ancestors lived in North Carolina during the Civil War.
Uh-huh.
Colonial.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, my ancestors during the Civil War lived in Italy. They were busy trying to find things to eat, like bark and grass and mud.
Right, right. Well, pretty much my entire family on both sides was here prior to the Revolution.
Yeah, well.
Mothers and fathers, except for my mother's mothers.
Have you checked that old family tree real good?
Oh, Betty? I've taken one branch all the way back to Robert the Bruce.
Oh, well, that's pretty impressive. But I'm talking more like
no, there doesn't seem
not
to be.
Robert the Bruce. I'm talking like maybe Robert the Man, you know.
That doesn't seem to have happened.
No.
My great grandfather, who was the last slave owner.
Yeah.
That whole family, when they came from Switzerland, I believe they were Mennonite, but because there weren't any Mennonite churches in North Carolina, they became like Methodists and stuff, but they were very devout.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
So there doesn't seem to have been a lot of
race mixing?
messing around down the quarters.
Yeah, well, if you ever find it, if you check one of those branches, Peggy, that shoots off into the darkness, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I've got, on my mom's side, I've gone back pretty thoroughly all the way around, all the way back to Switzerland and Scotland.
Well, you can never tell about a suppressed Mennonite, though, you know, that has to be a Methodist.
Well, that's true. My father was an excommunicated Mennonite.
Oh, my God.
From northern Indiana, from up around Elkhart.
Yeah, a bad place to be from. Yeah, Elkhart.
Yeah. Well, he was born on the farm outside Shipshawana.
Oh, well, that makes all the difference in the world. All right, Peggy, listen, good to hear from you.
You take care. Good to talk to you, too.
All right.
It's been too long.
Stay in touch. Stay in touch.
All righty.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Where's the ice pick? Paul is calling from Houston, Texas. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, this Paul.
Yes, sir. First time caller.
Well,
and I'm an atheist here in Houston, and I'm glad to have an atheist on the radio listen to your show as much as I can, and I really enjoy your show.
Well, bless you.
And you say that with no hint of irony.
No, none whatsoever, never.
Anyway, I just thought I'd point out that there is at least one piece of Christian BS that you've bought into, and that piece of Christian BS is the idea that there's lots of historical evidence for some sort of historical Jesus, when in fact there's actually not one single contemporary reference to Jesus, meaning nobody who was alive between the years 0 and 37 or so, when he was supposedly crucified, has written about him, and all the historical references are people afterwards mainly reporting, well, Christians did this, and nobody asked if there were Christians, of course.
Well, I don't have any problem with that. Take a look at this. Socrates, whom we all agree was a great, not that we all agree with his teachings, but he was an historical figure, and Socrates never put a single word down. Nothing that Socrates ever said was recorded by Socrates. It was recorded by Aristotle and other people, I'm sure scribes and who kept track. So since there is no... Plato, not
right.
Aristotle. Since there is no written record whatsoever of Socrates ever actually putting, so to speak, pen to paper or stone to mace, whatever, since there's no reason, how do we know Socrates actually existed? So,
well, as a matter of fact, there are some people who believe that Plato was a persona of Plato, that there was no Socrates as well. But you see,
kind of like Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe.
But the point is that when you're talking about historical evidence, there's a difference between saying, well, he could have existed, but we don't have any evidence, versus we have evidence.
Right.
Okay? There's no doubt that there were these stories written, and you might say,
I have to admit, you're right. I have bought into the the idea that there was an historical person. I think these learned or wise people, I think the Buddha was another one. I think Jesus was one. I think Martin Luther King Jr. was one. I think Gandhi was one. I think there have been many historical figures. Would you say the Buddha existed?
Well, obviously somebody wrote the words that is attributed to Buddha. Now, the question is was it written by one person? Was it written over time?
Well, yeah, I understand that. But I think there have been people, human people, who have crawled out of various wombs on this planet over the course of human history that have taken a look around and been shocked and tried to say to their contemporaries, this is not the best way to do this. There is a better way to do this. So, you know, Walt Disney was another one, you know.
Right.
I'm another one. So. Strom Thurmond. Anyway, Strom Thurmond was one.
Well, I'm a Founders Club member, so maybe when you get to 5,000 people, you'll draw my name. I
certainly might. All right. Thanks, Paul.
All right.
Appreciate you checking in. Oh, my goodness.
Only if Paul prays real hard on it, though.
Yeah, only if you pray real hard, like apparently Jennifer Hudson did. That was astonishing to me. How do people trivialize their belief or, you know, this cosmic God that they say they believe in, who created time and eternity and billions of galaxies and takes time out to make sure that Jennifer Hudson wins an Oscar? Or the Pimp song wins an Oscar. I sometimes wonder what. Oh well, I guess that's how you make it work. You personalize it. You know, it's just like personalizing your home webpage. You know, you personalize it. You make it an extension of your own damn self, and then it works. Then it works. Huh? William, a software diplomat, emailed in. He says, "Hi, Mike. Personally, I believe that God, quote, is caveman talk for what we call energy, because he didn't understand it at the time. In that case, since everyone has energy, that translates to everyone is a child of God. On the other hand, wouldn't it be neat to use the CSI stuff to recreate, using DNA from bone fragments, what Jesus looked like? Wouldn't it be a shock for some people in this country when they found out that he was dark-skinned? Yeah, and nappy-haired, and probably had all those kind of Mediterranean, African, Middle Eastern features that would just scare the hell out of a lot of white people. And then to add ice on the icing when they found out that he was related to Strom Thurmond. Whoa! Jesus, so to speak.
Yes, you know you got to get right with God.
Do not go gently into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
No, I think it's do not go gentle. And I don't think the poet knew anything about the flying monkey right, but that's all right. You know, your heart was in the right place. If you're not aware of this, because I certainly wasn't, this has been going on for 2 years. Palestinians and Israelis unite every week in protest at this hideous Berlin Wall that's being built, this 437-mile barrier that snakes through the West Bank, causing Palestinian people to be treated even worse than the Israelis have been treating them for the past 50 years. In The Guardian, UK, on Saturday, had an article about this. It says, let me just share with you a couple of sentences. It began as it has begun every week for the past 2 years. First flag waving, then chanting and marching along the high street of the West Bank village of Bilin until the demonstrators, yesterday several hundred in number, reached the barrier. There, facing a group of Israeli soldiers, they stood before the yellow metal gate and the barbed wire fences and continued chanting their opposition to Israel's half-built 437-mile barrier that snakes through the West Bank, in which the villagers say has taken half their land. Beyond the barrier and over the hill is the beginning of the largest Jewish settlement in the occupied territories, Modi'in Ilit. And this happens every week. There was pushing and shoving, then a volley of stones thrown by boys some distance away from the demonstrators. The Israeli military fired stun grenades and dozens of rounds of tear gas before eventually bringing out a water cannon to disperse the crowd. 16 people were injured, 4 of whom were taken to a hospital. The reason that Bilin is an exception is that the demonstrators here are Palestinians and Israelis. a rare mix of people who march and chant and espouse nonviolence together. And it goes on. You can find this at commondreams.org if you're interested. Israelis and Palestinians unite in protest at barrier is the headline. There is quite a bit of activity in Israel to bring an end to the apartheid state that Israel has become where it concerns the Palestinians. Efforts made by righteous Jews. Would that be fair? We talk about righteous Gentiles, those who put their lives on the line to protect Jews during the Holocaust years. Would it be fair then to call these people righteous Jews who, in fact, put their lives on the line to protect innocent Palestinians whose only crime is the fact that they are alive? I just found that story, and it's lengthy. You can read it if you want to. Kate in Mississippi, who normally lives in the desert, she's been on the road for several weeks now. She left her desert home and went to Mississippi to help in the Operation TLC Mississippi Home Again that Sarge has talked about a lot. She sent me an email. Mike, checking in to say thanks. You are the bright spot of my day. Take my Sirius satellite radio rig in my truck down by the water and watch the waves for 3 hours, letting the energy of the day wash away. Never mind that I am parked 2 blocks from Trent Lott's empty slab. The mission of Operation TLC Mississippi Home Again is to help the elderly, disabled, and single mothers who have fallen into the cracks. Every day the cracks get deeper and wider, the stories more horrific. The folks who are, quote, floating on the top, end quote, 540 days after the storm, are in such dire straits, sometimes I feel as if I'm down here giving hospice care to Jackson County. Appears that I won't get back to the desert this spring. Some big projects that will keep me here through June. Oh, God, the heat and humidity. Before folks started coming in this morning, needing something, I went to the post office to mail the monthly, quote, warm breakfast, end quote, box of oatmeal, canned ham, and peanut butter off to my Marines in Al Anbar province. Always wondering if it will be the last meal for some of them. No way of knowing who's dead and who will come home to Colorado. God, this is all so tiring. Keeping it lit, Kate in Mississippi, during the duration here, of course. You can check all this out at OperationTLC.org or UnreportedNews.net, Sarge's website. Just goes on and on. But Kate sent me an email several weeks ago and said she was going to Mississippi to do her part. And periodically she checks in like this. Thanks, Kate. You have my deepest respect. What else do we have here? Well, we got a break coming real quick. A new report out by McClatchy Newspapers, used to be Knight Ritter. The percentage of poor Americans who are living in severe poverty has reached a 32-year high. In addition to that, millions of working Americans are falling closer to the poverty line, and the gulf between the nation's haves and have-nots continues to widen. A McClatchy newspaper analysis of census figures found that nearly 16 million Americans are living in deep or severe poverty. The McClatchy analysis found that the number of severely poor Americans grew by 26% from 2000 to 2005. That's 56% faster than the overall poverty population grew in the same period. And it goes on. This report can be found at several places around the Internet also. And then an article that ties into this at truthout.org. 1 out of 6 Americans now depend on programs for the poor. The welfare state is bigger than ever. The number of families receiving cash benefits from welfare has plummeted since the government imposed time limits on the payments a decade ago. But other programs for the poor, including Medicaid, food stamps, disability benefits, are bursting with new enrollees. The result, according to an Associated Press analysis, nearly 1 in 6 people rely on some form of public assistance, a larger share than at any time since the government started measuring 2 decades ago. You know, and you look around and you see the steady parade of SUVs and people at the malls, and you think to yourself, Jesus, I mean, what's going on? What's going on? It is, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, certainly bizarre world, isn't it? All right, when we come back, proof beyond any kind of a doubt that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are supporting and funding terrorists. And remember what Bush said about that. Welcome back. 6 and a half past the hour. This is the Molloy program on Nova M Radio Network, also on Sirius Satellite Radio. Glad you could tune in. Thank you. Got an email here from somebody I haven't heard from for a while, Jerry Cimino, who runs the Beat Museum in San Francisco. Broadway at Columbus is where it's located. Jerry writes in, "Hey, Mike, you got to be kidding about O'Reilly's parents being brother and sister. Come on, talk about family values." Well, you know, you hear rumors, Jerry, and that's why John Gibson and Bill O'Reilly, who are full-blooded brothers, don't look that much alike, is because their parents are brother and sister. I don't know. I don't have any proof. Maybe if we did a DNA swab. Anyway, Jerry writes, "I hope you're well. We moved the Beat Museum to San Francisco a year ago, right across the street from City Lights Bookstore." Now, if there are any beatniks out there, or, God, beatniks have got to be older than dirt. I think all the beatniks are dead now. Go to Kerouac.com. I have a bumper sticker on my pickup truck that Jerry sent me a long time ago. Kerouac.com. Kerouac, as in the writer. Kerouac.com. And check it out. He also has a website, TheBeatMuseumOnWheels.com. TheBeatMuseumOnWheels.com. But Kerouac.com is a great website. And Jerry Cimino is a nice guy. Check it out. If you have any interest in that segment or that section of American literature that was so powerful post-war, post-World War II, it had its origins during the war and prior. Goes all the way back beyond before Carlos William Carlos Williams, but all the writers that contributed so much to truly American writing. I mean, this was as American as Mark Twain. Check it out. But I always found the Kerouac.com website to be oddly reassuring. I don't know why. I have no idea. Anyway, Jerry, thanks. Good to hear from you. All right. Seymour Hersh, who is rapidly becoming the single most critically dangerous to this administration investigative journalist out there. Seymour Hersh, not Bob Woodward, who's become nothing more than a whore for the Bush administration, not the Washington Post, which has become nothing but an organ for the Bush administration, but Seymour Hersh, who has most of his stuff published in the New Yorker magazine, and then usually is pre-released to various websites and is picked up. He has an article out in the current issue of the New Yorker that is absolutely astonishing. he says that the single most explosive element of his latest article involves an effort by the Bush administration to stem the growth of Shiite influence in the Middle East by funding violent Sunni groups. Now, keep in mind that the Egyptians, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the United Arab Emirates, the Jordanians, these are all Sunni regimes. Iraq and Iran. Iran is Shia. And what Bush has done by invading and occupying Iraq is to create a two-state monolith that is rapidly growing of Shia. And the ruling families in these other countries don't want that. They don't want it. Because the Shia, you can't deal with a Shia. Or something like that. Now, Hirsch says that the United States, that would be the Bush crime family, has been, quote, pumping money, a great deal of money, without congressional authority, without any congressional oversight, for covert operations in the Middle East, where it wants to stop the Shiite spread or the Shiite influence. Hirsch summed up his scoop in stark terms on the Blitzer program the other day. He said, quote, "We are simply in a situation where this president is really taking his notion of executive privilege to the absolute limit here." And he has more to say. Let's just play it for you in his own words. If you haven't seen this, go to thinkprogress.org. They have a partial transcript there, and then the full article. There's all over the place. I'm sure you can get it at TV News Live. I'm sure you can get it at a raw story, but I got it from thinkprogress.org, and find the bit there with Seymour Hirsch and Wolf Blitzer. So here it is from Late Edition yesterday. Former U-boat commander Wolf Blitzer interviewed Cy Hirsch about his latest investigative piece, and it's called "The Redirection," which is about the Pentagon war gaming an Iran attack. And eventually the conversation turned to Iran-Contra war criminal Negroponte's new position as Deputy Secretary of State. Blitzer finally asked the following. He says, "Cy, near the end of your article, you have this explosive point in there about John Negroponte, who is now going to be the Deputy Secretary of State. You write this, quote, 'I was subsequently told by the two government consultants and the former senior intelligence officials that the echoes of Iran-Contra were a factor in Negroponte's decision to resign from the National Intelligence Directorship and accept the position of Deputy Secretary of State,'" end quote. So, Cy, explain what you were hearing, because that's obviously a very explosive charge.
Yes, it's probably the single most explosive, if you will, or depressing or distressing sort of thing I discovered in the last few months, which is simply this. This administration has made a policy change, a decision that they are going to put all the pressure they can on the Shiites, that is the Shiite regime in Iran, the Shiite, and they're also doing everything they can to stop Hezbollah, which is Shiite, the Hezbollah organization, from getting any control or any more of a political foothold in Lebanon. So they we have been pumping money, a great deal of money, without congressional authority, without any congressional oversight. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia is putting up some of this money for covert operations in many areas of the Middle East where we think that we want to stop the Shiite spread or the Shiite influence. They call it the Shiite Crescent. And a lot of this money, and I can't tell you with absolute assurance how exactly, when and how, but this money has gotten into the hands, among other places in Lebanon, into the hands of at least three jihadist groups. There's three Sunni jihadist groups whose main claim to fame inside Lebanon right now is that they are very tough. These are people who are connected to Al-Qaeda who want to take on Hezbollah.
Connected to Al-Qaeda. Where's Oliver North when you need him? It sure sounds like Iran-Contra Redux to me, creating a proxy war by funneling cash to Sunni terrorist groups to stop Shias while claiming you're in a war against terrorists. I mean, I can't quite get my mind around this. We got time for one more here before the break? No? You want to stretch a minute? Let's do it. We'll stretch a minute. Now, this can get a little complicated, so here's a bit more explanation from Hirsch on the new covert terrorist funding the Bush administration is conducting. It looks like they're playing a role in the civil war in Iraq that keeps killing our troops! Isn't this, I hate to use the word ironic, this is vicious. Bush keeps fueling the killing machine he claims to be fighting against and just keeps throwing out troops into the meat grinder. Why do we impeach Clinton again?
So America, my country, without telling Congress, using funds not appropriated, I don't know where, but my sources believe much of the money obviously came from Iraq, where there's all kinds of piles of loose money, pools of cash that could be used for COVID operations. All of this should be investigated by Congress, by the way, and I trust it will be. In my talking to membership members there, they're very upset that they know nothing about this, and they have a great many suspicions. We are simply in a situation where this president is really taking his notion of executive privilege to the absolute limit here, running covert operations, using money that was not authorized by Congress, supporting groups indirectly that are involved with the same people that did 9/11. And we should be arresting these people rather than looking the other way.
This is incredible. This filthy son of a bitch in the White House and this killer Cheney, they are funding groups connected to 9/11. Do you understand this? What in the name of their God is it going to take to remove these bastards from office? Will somebody tell me that? Where are the Republicans on this? Bush supports terrorist groups with American money. Did Rush talk about this today? Did Hannity? Did O'Reilly? No, they didn't, because they hate this country too. They don't support the troops. They don't support the men who are, and women who are losing life and limb to weapons that Bush is purchasing for these terrorists. Bush is supporting the terrorists. Is that not ironic? That is exactly the charge these neocon bastards throw at Democrats. And they throw it at Democrats because the best defense is a good offense. If Democrats want to stop this war, then we're siding with the terrorists. Republicans are funding them. My God!
Next door, I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you. They arrested the mayor for an illegal favor, sold the Empire State to Japan, and Oliver North married.
I expect every member of this administration to stay well within the boundaries that define legal and ethical conduct.
Ah, shut up.
This means avoiding even the appearance of problems.
As we're doing this, I get this email from Reg in New York at tvnewslies.org. Reg, right, even as I write this, the top story on our 10 o'clock local news on Fox News is a warning to New Yorkers that Iran may be targeting us for a terror attack. Seems that they caught an Iranian or two some time back filming our subway tracks. Well, that'll do it. Betcha PNAC is setting up another attack on the Big Apple so Bushko can bomb Tehran. So if you don't hear from me, turn on CNN. All right, back to former German U-boat commander Wolf Blitzer interviewing Cy Hirsch on yesterday's late edition on CNN. Blitzer now brings the focus back to Negroponte's change of positions within the Bush crime family. Now, remember, if things in the Bush crime family get too tacky for a killer, an organizer of death squads in Central America like John Negroponte, that he wants no part of it. Holy jumping Jehoshaphat. Can you imagine? I mean, Negroponte is just, always has been, a filthy mass murderer. But it wasn't using nuclear weapons. He did it the old-fashioned way. Hire people to go kill for you. Now, Negroponte realizes that this psychopathic bastard in the White House, Dick Cheney, is going to order a nuclear strike against Iran. And what does Negroponte do? Yo, jubi jubis, let me out of here. So Blitzer says to Cy Hirsch, quote, your bottom line is that Negroponte is aware of all this, obviously, and he wanted to distance himself from it? Then that's why he decided to give up the position and take the number two job at the State Department?
That's one of the reasons I was told. Negroponte also was not in tune with Cheney. There was a lot of complaints about him because he was seen as much too of a stickler, too ethical for some of the operations the Pentagon wants to run. As you know, this Pentagon has been running covert operations. Under Rumsfeld, we were running operations all over the world with who knows what money and who knows what authority, because most of those operations were not briefed to the intelligence committees. John Negroponte went through this issue, Iran-Contra, in the 80s when we had the first big debate over the use of unlawfully obtained money to buy arms. You know, the whole arms for hostage business was to generate cash to fight the war, the Contra war against the Sandinistas, that mess that we had. Negroponte was ambassador to Honduras there, very sensitive to the issue that took place 20 years ago. He did not want a repeat of it. And I frankly, it's something that I think to be asking him in a congressional session or at a whatever. But I have that, you know, I understand this is very serious stuff. And my magazine understands this is very serious stuff. And we have really taken a lot of time with this story and couch it in as carefully as we could, and with all the caveats. This is serious business.
Too ethical. Negroponte is seen as too ethical for some of the operations the Pentagon wants to run? Oh, my God! How hideous and evil and bloody does a proposed Pentagon plan have to be before Death Squad boy John Negroponte says, oh no, too unethical for me, bye. Were they going to throw burning puppies at the Shiites? Were they going to make them watch back-to-back Britney Spears videos? Oh my God!
Plenty capable of conducting foreign policy for the United States in a way that reflects positively on my nation.
Oh, Jesus. Oh. 26 before the hour. You know, John Negroponte kind of fleshes out, personifies Shakespeare's comment about what is past is simply prologue. Negroponte and Robert Gates and Elliot Abrams and this Iranian arms merchant, Ghorbanifar, what's his name, John Poindexter, all of these murderous sons of bitches, these worms who crawled out of the corpse of the Iran-Contra fiasco, you remember them, the moral equivalent, Reagan called them, of the founding fathers of this country. And all the Contras were was a CIA-constructed group of thugs who didn't like the fact that the people of Nicaragua got rid of Somoza and installed a communist, or at least socialist, left-leaning regime under Ortega, who now, by the way, is the freely elected president of Nicaragua. But all of these scum came out of the 80s under Reagan. back at the time when Cheney, what's his name, Rumsfeld, were organizing the death squads in the Middle East, in Iran, or I'm sorry, in Iraq. It's mind-boggling what's going on here. Mind-boggling. And now we find out. Now we find out that the Bush crime family is funneling money, probably through his whores in the Saudi royal family, his enablers, the Sunni enablers in the Saudi royal family. Don't forget, they're the ones who funded the schools that were set up in Afghanistan, that allegedly produced the terrorists, that allegedly came to this country and murdered 3,000 people on American soil. God damn it, what does it take? What does it take to make this stop? And Cheney is over in Pakistan bitching to this little military dictator that he, the dictator, is not doing his job. And his job is to close down the terrorist camps on the Afghan-Pakistan border while Cheney and Bush are funding the sons of bitches. This is craziness beyond belief. And thousands and tens of thousands and eventually millions of people are going to die. Now, what does it take to get rid of the Bush crime family? What has to happen here, Truth Seeker? And meanwhile, we're sitting here, and as Reggie writes, you're goddamn right they're planning another bombing somewhere in this country. And by they, I don't mean Al-Qaeda. I mean Bush and the Bush crime family. And this would not have happened if people just would have taken a breath and realized what really happened on September 11, 2001 in this country. If there would have been a real investigation. But there wasn't. So here we are. Now, am I upset? Oh, Jesus, am I upset. And we have one guy, Seymour Hersh, every time Hersh comes out with another one of these mind-ripping exposés of this filthy dictator and his regime, I think to myself, Jesus Christ, this time, this is it. Seymour, you're going to get in a cab in Midtown Manhattan, and it's going to explode. Please be careful. One guy, when the history of this era is written, somebody better pay attention to the efforts of Seymour Hersh. One guy. Maureen writes in, Mike, I think Seymour Hersh should check out the money coming from the heroin trade in Afghanistan to fund the insurgency. Just a thought. Remember during Iran-Contra, the drug trade that developed out of that with the introduction of crack? There's a reason Cheney sneaks in and out of Afghanistan, to check up on the drug business. Negroponte was involved back then also. Maureen. Yeah, I remember. This is what... what's his name? Cop, the CIA. Rupert, Mike Rupert. What he was almost assassinated for, revealing this. This is what Robert Perry talked about, who still writes for ConsortiumNews.com, probably the most important website out there, as Bart Kopp says. KW writes in, did you hear what Cy Hersh said about cash sloshing around in Iraq funding these Al-Qaeda groups? Now we know where the 360 tons of cash went. Why, of course. Billions have been stolen. Where do you think it went? You know, a lot of people say, well, it goes to Cheney's offshore bank account. No, it doesn't. Cheney knows he's not going to be around long enough to spend that amount of money. He is a murderous son of a bitch. He wants death and destruction on a scale that would make Hitler spin in his grave. This is what the man wants. It's not in anybody's bank account unless it's in a Sunni terrorist groups. Jack writes in, good evening, Mike. If what the New Yorker columnist Seymour Hersh says is true, that the Bush administration is funding violent Sunni groups for covert operations in the Middle East without any oversight from Congress, then this is tantamount to treason. And it is imperative this lunatic be impeached from office before it's too late. I've said it before, Jack writes, and I'll say it again. This nefarious man in the White House is leading our once great country into the abyss. I truly hope it's not too late. Jack, right. Jack knows this. I know this. You know this, truth seeker. Everybody who listens to this program knows this. We all know this. Even some of these psychopathic, whiny-ass, thumb-sucking Republicans know this. Members of Congress know it. The Senate knows it. The House knows it. The Supreme, by God, court knows it. Everybody knows what's going on, and nobody's doing anything. Nobody in a position of power is doing anything. And you've got to ask yourself, why? What the hell is happening here? We have a bulletin here from BuzzFlash. Fresh off his Oscar victory, here's what it says. Fresh off his Oscar victory last night for Best Documentary, Al Gore has been stripped of his title by the U.S. Supreme Court. George W. Bush was declared the new winner, despite the fact that he has not received a single vote or even watched a movie in the last decade except for Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. In the court's opinion, new Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that he was proud to follow in the steps of his old boss and predecessor, the late William Rehnquist, who helped decide Bush v. Gore in 2000. Roberts said, quote, you gotta love lifetime appointments. We aren't even trying anymore, end quote. Insiders say a disappointed Gore has already begun regrowing his beard, although a spokesperson claims it is only so he can save money on heat now that climate change has made the winter months colder and more unpredictable. Meanwhile, jubilation abounded in Crawford, Texas, where George W. Bush was leisurely enjoying a few weeks off from his normal vacation spot in Camp David. Bush said, quote, I didn't even know you could win an Oscar for pretending to be something in real life, end quote. He also issued an executive order demanding that Martin Scorsese's long-awaited award for Best Director be given to Dick Cheney for his handling at the White House. Plans to melt the statue down into gold coins bearing Bush's likeness were scrapped after Bush decided it had been involved in terrorist activities. The statue is expected to arrive in Guantanamo by tomorrow morning, where it will no longer be under the jurisdiction of Roberts and the Supreme Court. So there you have it. Al Gore has been stripped of his Oscar. I'm not surprised. Oh, my God. This is from where? Where's this from? Is this from AP? Vice President Dick Cheney warned Monday that Al-Qaeda is regrouping in Pakistan's remote border region and sought President General Pervez Musharraf's help in a stiffened push against Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants, Musharraf's office said. Cheney's unannounced stopover en route to Afghanistan came as British Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett also held talks with Musharraf. But General Musharraf, I have a newsflash for you here from the United States. Cheney and Bush are funding the very people that they're bitching at you to go kill. Oh, never mind.
Pretty bad. Everyone's stiff. Dialogue so sad. If this were a movie plot, I would.
Don't be left out. Join your friends at the NSA and Homeland Security and listen to Mike Malloy every single night. They never miss a minute.
It's about 10 before the hour. All right, last soundbite. This is Tony Snow today, White House briefing, talking about covert operations here. Cheney made that unannounced trip to Pakistan to strong-arm Musharraf into getting tougher on al-Qaeda. Or maybe he was giving Musharraf money to give to al-Qaeda. You never know what these war criminal bastards. Ask Saddam. Well, you can't ask Saddam. He's been hanged. But one day they're giving you weapons. The next day you're being executed. Either way, Tony Snow wasn't talking despite numerous questions from reporters about all this. Instead, he just kept trying to rewrite the reporter's question with no success. So a reporter begins, Tony, as to Cheney's unannounced trip, does the president feel that General Musharraf has been aggressive enough in living up to the commitments that he has made?
You act as if a question like that seems to presume that everything is predictable. You do a certain amount of things and you'll get a predictable result. You're dealing with an unpredictable enemy. President Musharraf certainly has been responding to a changing threat. I think the appropriate question is, is he doing what he can? Is he committed to winning? The answer is yes.
The question is the president satisfied?
The president, as long as you have terrorists at large in the world, the president's not going to be satisfied.
The question is, did
Cheney... what you're trying to do, I'm not going to answer a question.
I have a very simple question. There's no trick question to this. The vice president was in Pakistan. He was meeting with President Musharraf. There are media reports that he was expressing the administration's dissatisfaction with the way that President Musharraf has conducted incursions or overseen the border regions. Is that the message that the vice president was delivering?
I'm not going to try to convey precisely what the vice president said. We're not going to be we're often asked to give out report cards on other heads of state. I'm not going to play.
I'm Prime Minister Maliki all the time.
No. Quite often, you guys will ask us, "Are you satisfied with X, Y, and Z?" And we talk about how we're working with
him. Oh my God! But you give out report cards on Maliki all the time. No. This is the most useless son of a bitch ever to occupy this office of White House spokesgeek. Julie Mason, writing in the Houston Chronicle, had this to say. White House spokesman Tony Snow made a startling claim earlier this month, one that shed some light on changing perceptions about the job he's doing. During a briefing, Snow responded to a question about climate change by noting that, quote, we're talking about nuclear development, which is now championed by, among others, Greenpeace, end quote. Beg your pardon? Snow said, quote, I think there's some Greenpeace people who are certainly advocates of nuclear power, end quote. As whoppers go, that was a good one. Certainly it was news to Greenpeace. Jim Riccio, Greenpeace nuclear policy analyst, said, quote, golly, you know, I can't believe the White House could get that wrong. Greenpeace was founded as an anti-nuclear organization, and we have been fighting nuclear weapons and their evil offspring nuclear power ever since, end quote. And then the Houston Chronicle writer, Julie Mason, goes on, White House reporters don't expect much from Snow, which goes part of the way toward explaining why his claim about Greenpeace went largely unremarked. Blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on and on. But it says here, most damningly, by Washington standards, many reporters covering the White House now don't believe Snow has the inner circle role or the access he was promised or that he claims to have. It's unbelievable. I mean, this just Greenpeace advocates nuclear power. Jesus Christ, yes. And PETA advocates eating meat 5 days a week. Puppy meat. And PETA has a new ad campaign where they advocate the clubbing of baby seals. Club as many as you can because the little bastards carry rabies. Did you know that? You didn't know that PETA has a campaign about that to stop rabies? Well, according to Tony Snow, they probably could. I don't know. I can't handle all this. Can you, True Seeker? Can you handle all this? I kind of maybe partially understand now why, I was going to say why CNN and MSNBC and Fox and the rest of these worthless, useless sons of bitches talk about Anna Nicole and go live for hours from a court hearing to decide what to do with her rotting corpse. Meanwhile, America is being murdered. It's because the executives can't handle it. What? Cheney did what? Oh, Christ, no. Go back to Anna Nicole. Oh, God. You know, you think it's that, and then you start to realize, no, it's not that, Malloy. Major media in this country is part of the problem, not the solution. Major media in this country already have the music and the graphics and the visuals ready for the next attack engineered on this country by the Bush crime family that will result in the death. You think 3,000 dead on our soil was horrific? Wait till these sons of bitches unleash the next one. Huh? You think 3,000? Of which about 2,400 were Americans? You think that was bad? And the networks have their music ready. I'm sure they've gone to who? Carl Orff, maybe. Maybe Beethoven towards the end of his life. John Williams is writing a new score. They've got the music ready. They've got the graphics ready. Major media in this country, electronic media, television. Oh, God. Oh, God. Bob Woodward, notwithstanding, they love this kind of stuff. Ooh, shoot 'em up, bang, bang. Let's see which one of these filthy horror networks can brand the next terrorist attack first. Seven past the hour. Now, during the break, I had an email from Scone. And he sent me a link titled Flashback, The American Hand in Iran. And the article mentions that AIPAC was pressuring the U.S. to support the Iranian Mujahideen Ilkhak, or MEK for short, for use against Iran's mullahs. MEK has been legally designated a terrorist organization since 1997 for killing U.S. citizens, for its role in the 1979 seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran, and for attacking coalition troops in Iraq. Human Rights Watch recently condemned them for use of torture, bombings, and assassinations. Nevertheless, 150 members of Congress have petitioned Bush to remove them from the terrorism list, and several lawmakers spoke at their 2005 convention in Washington, D.C. Now, excuse me, that was posted, earlier? What's the date today, Kathy? Is this the 26th? Today's the 26th? Yeah, this is posted earlier today. The article that Scone is referring to appeared in as an online blog at Asia Times, titled "The American Hand in Iraq." In Iran, is written by the writer is Trish Shu, S-C-H-U-H, S-C-H-U-H. So if you want this article, if you want to Google her, I guess, Trish Shu. Now, what Scone writes is, Cy Hirsch is crowing about his story of U.S. support to Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist groups, but the truth is that the blogs have had the story since 2005, when reporter Trish Shu first broke the story. Once again, the mainstream media is years behind the online reporters, but poses and postures as if they were the first with the news. All right, that's a good point. Excuse me, that's a good point. But here's a hard truth. There is so much good reporting, more good reporting going on in the blogs, much more than ever in comparison to mainstream media. There are still some good writers in mainstream media. I fully recognize and understand and support and congratulate and applaud and worship at the feet of and use all this information that comes from online blogs. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know that's the case, and we usually cite or try to cite the sources every time. My point with Cy Hirsch is that he is what he is. I mean, he can't escape. If Cy Hirsch goes and writes a blog, who's going to read it? Even though it's two years late. But the fact that Cy Hirsch is writing now for The New Yorker and is telling the truth about MEK adds something to the man's reputation. Could he have done it 2 years ago? I don't know. Maybe Cy Hirsch was working on something else. Maybe he didn't have this information 2 years ago. The blogosphere is so far beneath the radar in so many of these stories. And the only way it surfaces out from under the radar, so to speak, is if the stories that appear there are picked up by mainstream media. Now, here's a hard fact for anyone who still doesn't get it. 80% of America still gets 80% of its news from mainstream media. That's just the way it goes. So I agree with Scone, who sent this to me. I certainly agree with Scone that the story was broken 2 years ago. It's just like the Robert Perry breaking of the story on Iran-Contra. Way before mainstream media picked it up. And Robert Perry at the time was considered to be mainstream media. Now, if you want to go beyond Robert Perry, where it concerns Iran-Contra, you can go back to a Lebanese weekly that first reported the story of Iran-Contra, and then Robert Perry picked up on it and brought it to American American audiences, which kind of states the point. The Lebanese weekly never would have been read by Americans. That the funding for the Iran-Contra illegal, dirty, murderous war was being handled by arms traders, Israelis, Iranians, Oliver North, all sorts of dirty, filthy people who have just drenched in blood. It never would have made the radar screen in America except for Robert Perry. But it wasn't the result exclusively of Robert Perry breaking the story. The story was broken by a Lebanese weekly newspaper. Which leads us to the blogs. The blogs are invaluable. The blogs are forcing change in media. And 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 3 years from now, pick a date. The blogs will carry most of the real news, if they don't already. But I talk about Cy Hirsch's article because it is in the mainstream. It's where people can access it, where people can see it and go, holy Christ, you mean this is really going on? And here's another sad fact. When I come on this program and cite a blog, unless it's five or six of the top-rated blogs, people yawn. But if I cite the New York Times or New Yorker magazine or some well-known writer, then it gets attention. That's just the way the system works. The system sucks, but that's the way it works. So I appreciate the email here, and I'm in total agreement, Scone. Or SC1, however you say your name, in total agreement here with your point that the bloggers broke this story 2 years ago. I can remember our talking about this on either IE America, for God's sake, before it went defunct, or early on Air America about MEK. But the fact that this is being funded by the Bush crime family, In order to get that out to the American public, it's going to take more than the blogosphere. And the writers in the blogosphere are excellent writers. They're excellent researchers. They know how to use the internet to track everything down, to fix their facts and truly fix them. The 9/11 movement is one example of that. The 9/11 truth movement, I should say. So, Scone, I appreciate what you wrote, and I am in total agreement with you. I hope you can understand my point. You know, it's the old story. If a tree falls in the woods and nobody's there to hear it, is there a noise? For those of you trying to find the Seymour Hersh article, I've gotten a couple of emails. Go to New Yorker. It's at the New Yorker magazine. The CNN thing is just an interview that Wolf Blitzer had with him. It's the NewYorker.com, and you'll find it there. Okay. Let's do some phone calls. We got people holding on. Millie has been holding on for 2 hours. Millie, welcome to the program. Thanks for your patience.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Doing fine.
So you already spoke about a couple of things I want to talk about. Negroponte, too ethical. That was a great line.
Mm.
I saw it on Crooks and Liars yesterday. It's one of my favorite sites because I don't own a TV.
Yeah, by the way, let me just tell people that's where you can see that video, crooksandliars.com.
Yes. Yes, and it's the whole interview.
Right.
Because I don't own a TV, and that's how, because I need a filter. I can't stand the stuff on the TV.
I hear you.
You know, Daily Show, I go to my parents and watch it. But anyway, first of all, I have to say, you know, you are my guru.
No.
Yes, you are, because you know what? I didn't know how to scream until I heard you.
Okay, I'll be your scream instructor, but I'm nobody's guru except possibly my 3-year-olds. All right.
Okay.
All right.
I started converting from anger to like movement and.
I've
taken all these little baby steps. Well, two things that I've done that have really changed my mood from being totally depressed to feeling like I'm functioning in this world, as crazy as it is. And one is that I call Congress at least 2 or 3 times a week, call different members, call my Senate, and tell my friends and family to do it.
Mm-hmm. Millie, can you hold on a minute?
Go ahead. Yeah, sure.
Okay, I got to do a break, but just stay right there. Okay. We'll come right back to you right after the break.
Sure.
This is Nova M. I'm Mike Malloy. Stay with us.
Nation bleeding, still
Your Day Screaming with Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
21 past the hour. By the way, go to my friend Alex Jones's website, prisonplanet.com. Now, I know a lot of people think Alex Jones is a wacko and so on and so forth. You know, a lot of people think I'm a wacko. Go to prisonplanet.com. And at today's update of the site, you'll find a video. The BBC broadcasting team reporting that Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapse 23 minutes before it happens. I mean, if you want to see something that is astonishing, and if you have any doubts, oh, Jesus, you can't convince the unconvincible, but just go to prisonplanet.com, our good friend Alex Jones's website, and take a look at this BBC video. And good luck with your sanity after you watch it, okay? And read the article that's there with it, prisonplanet.com, and take a... About 20 of you have emailed this to me on various points today, and yeah, I've seen it, and it's look, I've got an overload switch just like you do, right? And I'm rapidly approaching that tripwire. An email from the person who owns the new website, and he didn't ask me, but I assume he wants me to mention it. It's called The Headline Roll.com. He says, all I want to do, or she says, all I want to do is help inform people. The Headline Roll, ROLL.com. The Headline Roll.com. Check it out. I went there during the break. Awful lot of news stories. So it's taken from mainstream media. I'm not saying this is a blog site, but it's another one of those sites where the selection process is done for you if you want to check out a site where there's a lot of news articles for a quick read. TheHeadlineRoll.com. Now, who are we talking to? Back to Millie. All right, Millie, thanks for holding on. Where were we? Where's Millie? There's Millie. Where were we,
yeah,
Millie?
Yeah. Can you hear me, Mike?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay, all right. Good point about your overload switch, because what I wanted to say was that, you know, for so long I was taking all this stuff in, watching movies and going through internet sites and getting all this information that was so heavy, right, that I didn't have that release valve. Or I, you know, so this is where first you taught me how to scream, and then I got the valves and started going to different groups. But the two things that I'm doing now that are, and everyone's different, of course, but the two things that are most convenient for me is doing the calling the Congress, and I do think it does make a difference. The marches and the Congress, you just don't see it right away. If we don't call, you're not going to know
right,
what we're feeling. If we don't march, they're not going to see the numbers, even though it's not on the TV. But to be there and to see other people who feel like you do, it's really, it gives you a lot of energy. Now, the other thing that I do is now I am like the precinct head of my precinct voting, so I'm in the voting. I'm a volunteer, and I'm working on the elections, and that helps me because I feel like I bring other people in with me. At work, I get a couple of people. Don't be afraid to ask people to join your marches, and give them a phone number to Congress. Hand out leaflets, things. I print out stuff that are really interesting, and I carry a lot of discs. I have it in my cubby at work, a lot of movies, American Blackout, Why We Fight, all kinds of things. I buy them, Iraq for Sale, tons of great DVDs. Somebody says something, they don't believe the information I'm giving to them, and I give them the DVD, and wow, do their heads spin around.
I'll bet.
So you cannot don't underestimate somebody because they're not informed. The reason they're not informed is because of the media. So unless you just give them a taste, like I had a taste, somebody told me listen to Air America a couple of years ago, and that was my first introduction. So give somebody the chance to learn, even if they're a righty. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Okay, and the other last thing, Snowball is doing his job, because the more confusion there is about any information and any people are just going to, you know how it is, take a group of 10 people and have three different directions to do one simple project.
Right, right.
Nobody will know what to do. What happened in Ohio? Nobody knew what to do. That's why we lost the election.
Mm-hmm.
They had 10 sets of directions. Am I correct? Do you remember?
Well, No, you're making
so
great
he's
sense.
He's totally doing his job. This is the whole idea, is to make people so confused that they are disinterested and will disengage.
Well, this is the reason the Republicans went after Clinton for his little so-called infidelity or escapade, was to so poison the atmosphere that would turn people off to the entire political system. and they would stay home. And then these right-wing nutballs could take control, which is precisely what happened.
Okay.
Hey, Millie, I got to leave you there. Thank you so much. I appreciate your call. Take care.
Ready for Radical Talk Radio? Make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
And don't even get me started tonight on Joe Lieberman. Oh, Jesus. Oh. Maybe we'll get to that tomorrow night. All right, back to your phone calls. Colleen is calling from Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Colleen.
Hi, Mike. I was calling about these drills that they had today, or apparently had today. I think it was today. I heard about preparing for terrorist bombs in the United States. Did you hear about those?
I haven't, but I've missed a lot of television today.
Well, I just heard a blurb. I'm not really informed on it, but it was... It just kind of went along with when they attacked the Trade Center. When it happened, I thought to myself, not even these people are that evil, are they? And I've seen in plain sight. I know they're that evil. And having these drills is just getting people there prepared for when they start the attacks here.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I have no doubt any longer. I've been saying for a couple of years on this program, I don't know what the truth is of 9/11, but I do know that what has been told to me as the truth is not the truth.
That's right.
And beyond that, I wish there would be a competent investigation by people who are interested in finding the truth. And until that time, I just know the story that is put out there by the Bush crime family is one I reject. That's all.
That's the way I feel about it, too. And I was wondering if anybody checked Cheney's plane coming back from Pakistan, make sure he isn't bringing them back with him.
Yeah, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. I swear to God, I wouldn't.
These people, me either.
They're capable of anything.
Yeah, they
anything.
Are. They are, and if we ever are fortunate enough to get these criminals out of the government, we need to put the entire government under a microscope and take it apart and stop this from ever being possible to happen again.
I hear you.
I'm sick for my country. I really am.
Well, The mechanisms are already in place to stop this from happening. It's called the U.S. Constitution. But when you have a criminal outlaw enterprise like the Bush crime family that doesn't give a damn about the law, never has,
well, but
never will.
They were enabled because of the Congress being on their side. And that, somehow or another, that imbalance can never happen again. If there hadn't been they wouldn't have been able to do what they've done.
That's true. But what's necessary for that to take place is an electorate, voters, citizens who actually give a damn about the survival of their country.
Well, and even when they do, it's stolen from them. I mean, today they declared that election that is so bogus in Florida that, oh, there was no problem. The scanners were fine.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I do agree with you. But when an election is stolen, the way the 2000 and the 2004 elections were stolen, and then you take a look at how many Americans actually turned out to vote, and then you take a look at the 2006 elections, where Democrats in record numbers turned out and overcame the programming in these machines.
Mm-hmm.
The machines were programmed to make it look as though it were a close election. When you have overwhelming numbers of Democrats turn out, this is what Greg Palast talked about. If they're going to steal it, make them steal it big. And they weren't prepared, and the machines were not programmed to steal it big. So I still maintain.
But where are we going to come out with that many more people to come out next time to stop them the next time?
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. In order to stop this from happening, we don't need to pass laws. We have the documents in place. It's called the Constitution of the United States.
So you mean worthless piece of paper?
Yeah, right. Although Bush used the word other than worthless. And until such time as the Constitution once again becomes the preeminent document in this country, not Bush's signing statements, until that time, then we're kind of screwed. So it's up to us. If we lose this republic, it's going to be, and I hate to be harsh, it's going to be because we gave it away. So,
well, I'm with you on the boxes, the ballot box and the others. The revolution is coming if this doesn't stop.
I hear you. Thanks a lot for checking in.
And happy anniversary to you guys.
Thanks, Colleen.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Right,
take care. Bye-bye. The boxes she's referring to, the four boxes for use in the defense of liberty, we've talked about this. Soap, ballot, jury, ammo. Use in that order. Oh, my. Dr. Dave is calling from Venice, California. Dr. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hello, comrade. Good evening.
Yeah, good evening.
I knew I had to call tonight when you asked rather earnestly, are there any beatniks out there?
Uh-huh.
I took it personally, throwing down the gauntlet. And
you are one?
Huh?
You are one?
I remain a beatnik, have lived as one, and plan to die as one. Sure.
Well, you have my undying respect.
Yeah, well, you know, what else am I going to do? Nice work if you can get it. That's just the way it goes down. But I very interesting things, touch on a few very briefly, that I've gleaned from the news just over the past weekend.
Yeah.
Now, the Cy Hirsch story. Of course, I guess that went public, even though it was in the New York originally. He was on CNN with the Wolfman
right.
on Sunday.
Right.
You know, and that involves a plan that when it is green-lighted, a 24-hour, essentially, shock-and-awe carpet bombing campaign of Iran is supposed to begin. And the follow-up to that story, which I didn't get from the source, but I believe I heard it on Democracy Now! From Amy Goodman this morning, reported in all places in the New York Times by Frank Rich, is that once again, as before 9/11 2001, the administration has been warned of this impending attack.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan is not to do anything for what I guess, at least to me, is the obvious reason, is to shift further into all-out martial law, you know, and elimination of dissent. So that's something you might want to keep your eye.
There is information floating around that, like the President's Daily Brief, the PDF that said Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. that there is something about Iranians.
Well, no. The although it is exactly that type of memo to which I refer, and that the response or non-response to that memo would be. The same again. I mean, they really do have a limited playbook, and so
you and I and most thinking Americans understand, though, that Iranians are no more interested in attacking America than the Iraqis were.
Well, yeah, that should go without saying.
Yeah, they don't. They just don't give a damn. They have their own country. They have their own business to get about. It's the Bush crime family that creates these straw men, these monsters.
Of course.
When in fact it's the machinations behind the scene, the little man behind the screen is usually Cheney, or Negroponte, or Elliot Abrams, or
sure.
or Poindexter. Pick a name.
Yeah. Well, I was actually shocked when I heard that the ratio of the perpetrators of violence against U.S. troops vis-a-vis IEDs, you know, that sort of thing,
right.
roadside
right.
explosive devices and all that, is, you know, roughly 85% Saudi-sponsored Sunni militia. I forget which is the militia and which is the death squads now, but...
Well, I think the Sunnis are the death squads and the Shia are the militias.
Right, but the fact that that most of this... the whole thing about that we're supporting al-Qaeda and the Sunnis, again, that they are responsible for that large a majority of the attacks against the GIs as they mm-hmm. uselessly patrol for these IEDs. And yeah. if you want to laugh, by the way, you know, the whenever some White House spokes zombie is questioned about an investigative report coming out by Cy Hirsch, who obviously comes out with a number of these things, they say the same bloody thing every time. But I have to quote to you with this one new gal they have, this new Kool-Aid drinker. I have never seen or heard of her before. But her response was, and I quote, her pronunciation, Cy Hirsch is a known wanton liar and critic. I repeat, wanton, as in Chinese menu. So they're on top of things. By the way, back on the Beatnik thing,
yeah.
A lot of this stuff that I've been falling down off the web, you can get the entire Pull My Daisy 1959 Beat
great,
classic.
Great
you know
movie.
About that?
Great movie. Oh, yeah, I met Robert Frank, the guy who directed
right.
it.
So you got your Young, Ginsberg, and Corso.
Oh, it was a great film. Great
it
film.
It is a stone groove.
Yeah, it was a great film. Thanks a lot for checking in, Dr. Dave.
Pleasure talking with you.
Stay in touch.
Will
Stay
do.
In touch.
Thanks,
all
pal.
Right. All right, sir. Yeah, Robert Frank, who directed and shot Pull My Daisy, one of the best documentaries on the Beats. It was made back in the late 50s, early 60s, I believe. And I had the good fortune of spending 10 days with Robert Frank in Boulder, Colorado. Oh, my God.
The new Prime Minister of India is... no. Mass destruction.
Ten before the hour. Thanks to Ian Huff, who engineered the program in Phoenix tonight and handled your calls. Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent. Mark Marshall, our webmaster. The moderators at MikeMalloy.com on the message board. And don't try to run one past the moderators, because you won't be able to, okay? Catherine Bay is our executive producer. Please go to NovaMRadio.com and sign up for downloads and podcasts and a chance to win $10,000, all right? Now, regarding Dr. Dave, our caller before the break, see, if you're true beatnik, you know what the movie Pull My Daisy is all about. Huh? Not trying to get all insider on you or anything, but it was the... a lot of people, I among them, consider Pull My Daisy to be the seminal beatnik movie ever made, and it's a documentary. Robert Frank was also... I can't say it on the air, but it was a Mick Jagger film. I can't say it. Robert Frank was the I think cinematographer on that one. But having gotten an email from our friend at Jerry at Kerouac.com this evening, haven't heard from him for a long time, and I wondered if that site was still up. Because I still have the bumper sticker on my pickup truck. But go to Kerouac.com, just for the hell of it. Beatniks. That just seems like a million, trillion generations ago. I dated a girl back in Toledo, Ohio, when I was in high school, whose brother and two other guys owned a coffee house called... The Noble Thought. The Noble Thought. And in that coffee house, they, honest to God, they had a sax player would get up all by himself, a guitar player, and the waitresses, yes, wore black leotards. And no alcohol was served, but all kinds of coffee and chocolate drinks. This is before Starbucks was even thought of. And one night, a friend said, "Are you going to the Noble Thought tonight?" I said, "Why? What's up?" "Well, there's some people from this organization called Students for a Democratic Society out of Michigan who are holding a recruiting drive." I said, "No, you're kidding." And that was the first time. SDS was not all that radical at one time. The Noble Thought coffee houses. Oh, see, I'm going all nostalgic. I'm just sitting here just thinking about the Weavers and some of those singing groups from, and Kerouac reading his stuff, and Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti and Gregory Corso and who else? Oh, my God, it just goes on and on and on. Daniel Berrigan, not the priest. Herbert Hunke. Peter Orlovsky. Yes, Catherine.
Yeah, good thing all those people are dead before today. Well, they'd be turning somersaults.
Michael Moore, who I think probably is still writing poetry somewhere in San Francisco. Not the filmmaker. No, not Michael Moore. Michael, drawing a blank. Happens a lot. But in 19, just as an aside, I know nobody gives a damn, but in 1982 in Boulder, Colorado, there was a 25th anniversary celebration of the publication of On the Road. It came out in 1957, and everybody in the beat movement that was still alive showed up. I went. I was the only person from Atlanta that went. Jan Kerouac was there, Jack Kerouac's daughter, a couple of his ex-wives. Timothy Leary was there. Abbie Hoffman, just you name it. The discussions were incredible. It went on for 10 days. It was held at University of Colorado in Boulder. 10 days of seminars. I went as a member of the press, but also paid the $250 fee. So I just kind of had full access to everybody. Allen Ginsberg was there. Larry, as they called Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Gregory Corso, the whole crew, and one by one, I've watched over the past, when was that, 82, was that 25 years ago? It's time for the 50th anniversary. I can't believe the time has gone by. But in that 25-year period, almost every single one of those people has died. They're gone. Not all, but almost all. Beatniks. Time it was, and what a time it was, huh? We got time for one more call, Kathy. All right. John, New York City. Hey, John, welcome to the program. John?
Mike, thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Though I was really enjoying your reminiscence of the Beatniks. It was before my time, but I was enjoying your memories of it in any case. You know, I called you a little less than a year ago, very frustrated at the lack of anybody really questioning what occurred on 9/11, other than you, notably, and a few others. But what I am encouraged by now is it's like I meet people on the street. Just a guy comes over and tunes my piano. I talk, and it seems it's out there. But the thing that really boggles my mind, Mike, is that it's, and I understand it's so difficult for us to get our heads around this. It's such a risk for somebody to come out there for. People who I like and respect, a Paul Krugman, an Al Franken, or whoever, a Michael Moore, as you mentioned, to come out and say, you know what, we really haven't been told the full story here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I empathize with them on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's like with what may take place in Iran, I just think we're at such a dangerous point, and the truth has got to be spoken.
I agree with you. John, we're out of time. Listen, I know I held you on hold for an awful long time, so if you'll call back tomorrow later on in the week, I'll put you on first, all right?
Certainly. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. And thanks to Russ. The poet I was thinking of is Michael McClure. Michael McClure. And don't forget Gary Snyder. Russ writes. Yeah, Gary Snyder, Michael McClure. His wife, McClure's wife, came to that convention also. Oh, my. Thanks a lot for participating tonight. However you did that, I do appreciate it. I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.